Well, thank you everyone for coming to the Blue Ridge Public Radio Listening Lounge. We're here with the Museum of the Cherokee People. This is Dakota Brown. She's our education director, and Evan Mathis, who is our collections director. And they're going to talk a little bit about the new exhibit that's coming to the Museum of the Cherokee People, which is all about tribal sovereignty. Thanks so much for coming today, you guys.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Just to get started off, since it's such a nice little group, do you want to each talk a little bit about how you got into museums and how you got into this position? I just love those stories from both of you.
Yeah, sure. I think that they're maybe not a traditional path to museums. I don't think either one of our stories are that. Do you want to go first?
I went to UNC Charlotte. I started in the architecture program. I did a year of that, and I really, really hated it. I haven't drawn anything since then. And then I just decided to do general education at that point, and then they said you have to pick a major, so I had the most credits in history, and I went with history. I was like, well, apparently I really like history, so that's what I went with. I got a history degree, and I moved back home 2014, and the only job I could find was to work night shift in the ER doing patient registration, and it was awful. And from there, I worked my way up into the supply department, and then I became the manager of the supply department. And in the supply department, we were tracking assets, we were doing all the orders for the hospital and all of the outlying clinics. We had to do special orders for specific medical equipment, and the asset tracking piece was really helpful, and maintaining shelf locations for all of our supplies was really helpful for collections. And in the meantime, like, my best friend from college was like a hardcore museum person. She became the director of decolonizing initiatives out at the San Diego Museum of Us, and she just kind of always kept me in her world and like took me along with her and encouraged me to go into museums. And then I also worked with Lynn Harlan at the hospital. And she's an Eastern Band person that has museum experience from all over the United States as well. And she was also telling me, like, you really need to go into museums. And so it was weird how my experience at the hospital really translated over well to collections care. And yeah, it was an interesting story. And I'm currently enrolled in the Institute of American Indian Arts for the Museum Studies Postgraduate Certificate Program. So it's not a master's program, but it's really cool because all of my instructors are enrolled citizens of federally recognized tribes. So I get to learn about museum studies best practices from an indigenous perspective, which is interesting. And it's online, so I get to stay at home, which is important to me too.
I was just going to comment on Evan's hiring. I was a part of the hiring process, but our executive director, Shana Bushiad Condal, spoke a lot about some of the interviews that she was having and how it was a pretty, I don't want to speak for her, but it was a pretty traumatizing experience because there was a lot of academics and longtime collection professionals that applied for the role, for Evan's role at our museum. And there was a lot of, like, I would say, like, arrogance that they brought with them about how they could help us with our objects. Being a tribal museum, we felt pretty confident that we could have somebody learn the ins and outs of collections care. But what we couldn't teach is care and understanding of what that meant and what that looked like for a tribal community and for Cherokee objects cared for in a Cherokee way. And so that was something that Evan really brought to the table when he came on, is that he had this very, like, clear understanding of how he would approach that and why that was important for us and our organization. So that was really
great. I skipped over a lot because I'm nervous, but so I'm not a tribal member. I am a community member, though, and I've been doing beadwork since I was 15 years old. EBCI tribal members taught me how to bead and how to make moccasins, how to make my own regalia. I've experimented with basketry, pottery, a little bit of carving, not very much, finger weaving. So I know how to make all of the objects that I'm caring for. And so when you have that intimate relationship with how the objects are made, it gives you a different level of understanding, I guess, of the objects. And then in the meantime, I was also like, especially with my beadwork, I learned like the intertribal like powwow style of beadwork, and I was really interested in what beadwork looked like historically for our community. And so I was traveling to museums all over the country, tracking down like pre-removal beadwork, pre-Trail of Tears beadwork, and seeing what those looked like and how we could incorporate those designs back into our community. So that's also a lot, how I got a lot of museum experience as well.
That's cool. Yeah, I think for those of you who, thank you for joining us, we're talking about the Museum of the Cherokee People's Tribal Sovereignty Exhibit, and Evan was just introducing himself as the collections director. And I think, you know, your story and Dakota, the way that you talk about the objects that are in the museum is such a part of, I feel like, the changes that y'all have made in the last few years at the museum. I'm the regional reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio, so I talk to y'all a lot about what's going on at the museum, but also, you know, the national policy around it, whether that means the Native American Graves Protections Act and Indian Child Welfare Act, and how all of those pieces of tribal sovereignty, like, are also such a part of the conversation in the museum when you're talking about beadwork and all these pieces. Can you tell everyone a little bit more about the way that you've kind of changed the way that you're presenting objects at the museum, I think through the disruption and stuff? And then Dakota, I don't think you got to really introduce yourself, but dove into explaining that you're clearly the education director.
Do you want me to start with, I guess, like, explaining how I got into the museums and then
just
go there?
Bit.
Okay, yeah. So I don't really have, it wasn't a clear path that I chose to go into museums. What I would say is that I knew that I wanted to serve my community in some way. I knew that I wanted to be of service of my community and give back to my community in some way. And I was always kind of a history nerd. Growing up, I would read my history books for fun in the evenings. I was so cool. I would read my history books in the evenings for fun. I loved history. What I love about history is that it tells you why things are the way that they are. And I love to look at that and understand that and be as knowledgeable as I can about why things are the way they are now. And so I was thinking about history early on when I was in college, and I went to one of my history professors, and he was like, "That's really dumb, don't do that, there's no jobs," is what he told me. And so I actually started to go to school for finance because I'm decent with numbers. Due to some family issues, I ended up having to move back home. I was actually at UGA studying finance, and I had to move back home and be closer to my family for a little while. And during that time, I worked in the marketing department at the casino, and it was really close to the finance department. And I would walk in there, and there was no windows in their office, and they were all like hunched over at their cubicles, just like really typing away. And I was like, wow, I don't think I can do this. I don't think that this might not be the life for me. So I decided that I wasn't going to return to UGA, and that I was going to do something different. And I always went back to history. And so I decided to get a degree in history from UNC Asheville. And once I completed that, I was just, again, looking for a way that I could serve my community. I got a job at the museum in a different position. And I did come to my role in a very unique way. We were in a time of interim leadership, and basically they were needing to fill the job descriptions in a way that was like board approved. And so I just was asked if I wanted to step into that role. And I absolutely had no idea if I was going to continue to maintain my role as director of education. When our executive director came on board in 2021, we got a new executive director, Shana Bushiad Condal. And I just told her when she came on board, I was like, I have no idea if this is the right spot for me. I don't know if this is the right place for me to be. I just want to work here. And so, you know, wherever I make sense to be in this space, I would like to just continue to have a job here. But I don't necessarily, you know, want this role. I never really applied for it. And so she kept me as the director of education. I'm currently in my last year at Johns Hopkins University, getting my master's in cultural heritage management. I definitely felt like I needed to, if I was going to maintain that role, I needed to make sure that I had the education to back it up. So I went on and pursued my master's. So anyways, that's how I got my role at the museum. I'm very happy that I have the role that I do. I do think that I've found a way to make it a successful division at our organization, and we've been able to bring on wonderful folks like Evan, and we're growing our team all the time at the museum, and we have an amazing, talented team, and I'm honored to work there.
You know, the museum basically has gone through a lot of changes, and yeah. Annette's on the board and stuff, so she can maybe speak to that a little better, but when the new museum director came on in 2021, they basically have changed the way that they're talking about the objects that are at the museum, and that Absolutely. Started with the disruption exhibit, if you guys want to touch on that, and then I think it was a clear path to the new exhibit that's coming, to clear to me, for tribal sovereignty.
Yeah, so a little bit about the shift at the museum. Our museum started in a time when the Cherokee was trying to find some sort of economic stability for our community. We were one of the poorest communities in the U.S. at the time. This is, 1940s, 1950s. And there was an opportunity to negotiate an entrance to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park for the Quala boundary. And so the tribal government at the time was able to negotiate that entrance to the park there on Highway 19. And all of these like tourism attractions rose out of that negotiation for that entrance, because we were going to have an influx of people coming through the Quala boundary. And so our museum is one of the things that came out of that. Our museum was founded in 1948. It is one of the oldest tribal museums in the nation. And we really had a heavy focus on tourism and appealing to a tourist economy, especially a tourist economy that was, I guess, based around like an Indian image or a stereotypical Indian image. And so that was kind of how our museum was born, is that we were born out of this, I guess, like need to draw tourists in to our community. And it worked for a really long time, and it's continued to work. And we did build a tourist economy for our community, and it completely changed our community in the way that we were able to function. Families were able to provide for their kids and provide for their families and put food on the table because of tourism. And but what I would say is that as that tourist economy has shifted over time, we no longer really have to have these, I guess, like Indian stereotypes that we portray in our community to draw tourists to our community. They're coming there for other things. And so it allows the museum, we're in a really unique time right now, that it allows the museum to really focus on community and really focus back on our Cherokee culture and telling our story our own way. And that's what we've been focused on the past few years, is really shifting that focus back to our community, back to our own stories as Cherokee people. And so that's kind of where the ideas for disruption comes from. And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about like where disruption comes from and why.
Yeah, so I didn't say earlier, but I started working at the museum in December 2021. And in January 2022, we did our first known inventory of the permanent exhibit that was installed in 1998. And I'll say that, and I said this in my interview, one of the reasons I wanted to work at the museum is because you can walk through the museum and you can see objects that are likely to be NAGPRA eligible. NAGPRA is the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act.
Or you could at the time.
Yes,
no
you
longer.
Could at the time. You could in 2021. And
could you tell them what that means, just in case people don't know?
Yeah, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act is a federal law that was passed in 1990, and it gives tribes the right to claim back ancestral human remains, funerary objects, and objects of cultural patrimony. And so an object of cultural patrimony is like a ceremonial object that is needed today to be used for ceremonies that happen in indigenous communities today. And so, yeah, it's a federal law, and you could walk through the museum and, you know, if you know anything about archaeology, when there's 40 intact archaeological pots on the shelf, it's likely that those were looted from a grave, because you don't find fully intact pieces of pottery outside of a grave context usually. And so, and there was also like rumors around the community that there were things that shouldn't be in the museum's collections. And so I really wanted to do right by those collections, and I, you know, that was a big draw for me to go there, is to do that hard work. And so, yeah, we did the inventory of the permanent exhibit. My suspicions were correct. There were objects that, there was even like some pots that said from Indian grave on the bottom, and it was really, I think we've cried as much as we can about it
yeah,
at this point.
So,
like
too.
We have no more tears left to cry. But it's just really gross to think about graves being robbed and looted and then put on exhibit in a museum. And the other thing is, a lot of the objects are not even Cherokee. They're from, a lot of them were from Arkansas or Missouri or all over the place. And that goes back to the lack of indigenous self-representation in the museum in the past. Scholars at the time thought that Mississippian was a culture and not a time period. But there were multiple people that participated in the Mississippian era. So it's important to recognize that that's a time frame and not a culture. And so obviously Cherokee participated in that and existed then. But depending on where the objects are found would make them Cherokee, or they would belong to another tribal community. And so we consulted with our TIPO office. TIPO stands for Tribal Historic Preservation Office. And they were able to confirm that everything I had flagged as potentially NAGPRA eligible was culturally sensitive. I missed 5 arrowheads, so yep. I was kind of proud of myself. But they confirmed my suspicions, and we were left with the decision to pull all of those objects and have empty shelves, which we all talked about would have been a teachable moment. But there was another issue on our exhibit, which is that it ended in about 1920, circa 1920. So there was a whole 100 years of Cherokee history missing, because Cherokee people are contemporary living modern people. So we decided, rather than to leave the shelves empty, we would invite artists from the Eastern Band and Cherokee Nation to participate in creating contemporary art to put in those places that we had pulled NAGPRA eligible objects off view.
And we settled on the name Disruption because it obviously disrupted this idea about having funerary objects or ceremonial objects on display that's really common practice in most museums. So it disrupted that. But the other thing that it disrupted was that archaeological timeline that took you like from the paleo period all the way through the 1920s. And so we wanted to disrupt that as well, because it's a really common theme or a common way to approach Native exhibits is through this archaeological timeline. It kind of like starts in one period and moves to the next period, and that's sort of how you move through Native exhibits. And so that is why we chose the name Disruption, is it just really, and I think it actually came from one of the artists that's in the shows, that was exhibited in the show, Luzine Hill is the one that actually kind of come up. We had been grappling with a name that had Disruption in the title.
Disrupting the timeline.
Yeah, I think that was the name. And she was like, why don't you just call it Disruption? And so that was kind of how the name was born, so.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it really did disrupt. I mean, I remember, so I'm from Franklin, which is just over the mountain from here, and, like, we always came to the Cherokee Museum and on field trips and stuff, and that exhibit had not changed my whole life.
Yes,
and
no.
So, like, this was such a huge change to go to the museum and see not only where things had been removed because they shouldn't have been on view, but then to see modern Cherokee artists reimagining those things and putting whatever they wanted forward. So
yeah, and I think powerful. One of the things that that we did with the artists is that we didn't give them any kind of, we didn't censor them in any way or give them any parameters. Their only parameter was the case itself. And so they were kind of able to come in and look at the cases and decide what they wanted to put. We had some artists that did things that we had no idea, they worked in mediums that we had no idea that they had ever worked in before. We had other artists that we were sure would want to be in a particular section that were like, I don't want to do that, and would decide to be in a completely different section. So it was a really great opportunity to work with some of the artists in our community and kind of have them explore what this meant to them. And some of them really directly made pieces that were about the exhibit or were in a direct response to the exhibit. And others were just, you know, about Cherokee people today and our lives and that sort of thing. So it was really interesting to see how they chose and the items that they chose to put in the exhibit.
We also had a lot of people that were exhibited for the first time, and they said that we heard over and over and over again, I'm not an artist. They were like, I make things, but I'm not an artist. And they were totally artists. Like, it was, we had some really awesome pieces submitted for that. And so it was cool to see people like switch from, oh, I just make things, to, oh, I'm actually an artist and I can like submit into, like, we've had them go on and submit into other exhibits as well, which is really cool to see.
I think one of the most interesting things that happened during disruption is the visitors that would come in. We got a lot of, like, why are there new artifacts? Which was, like, one of my favorite things that people would say. I was like, oh, read the signs, read the interpretation. But, yeah, that was always, like, so funny because, right, like, that was disrupting their thoughts of what their, and disrupting their expectations of what they were going to see when they went to see an Indian exhibit or went to see a Cherokee exhibit. They were being confronted with this idea that, like, their expectations was to see arrowheads and was to see, like, primitive tools and, like, dioramas of, like, Indian life, right? Like, that was their expectations. And so to come in and see contemporary Cherokee artwork was, I think, sometimes hard for some of them to grapple with, and we were fine with it. Our community loved it, though, and our community, that was one of the things that I loved about it. It was one of the first museum events that I went to, the opening, where it was just, like, all community members in that room. And that was pretty exciting and wonderful to see, is just like being in this room with our community members, like looking at their family's artwork and things like that that was in our exhibit, was something that I hadn't seen before, and I hadn't seen them show up in that way. And so it was really nice to see that as well.
Can you talk a little bit about the decision on what to do next? I mean, disruption, I know you had already been planning to do something different, and disruption was kind of this like interlude. What was the conversation at the museum around making a new exhibit?
Yeah.
So I would say we refer to disruption as a Band-Aid fix. Like, it was an emergency for us to get those objects off view. And I think we're in our next, not quite emergency, but our next Band-Aid fix. With the sovereignty exhibit. So we have plans to build an offsite collections facility. It's been in the works since literally 1994.
But not from our museum.
Not from our museum.
From
but
our tribe.
You know more about it than I do. You're better
you
at this.
You can go ahead.
No.
You're doing great.
I feel like you're doing so good. Okay, so the museum currently has plans. When Shana came on board, one of the board's things that they wanted her to do, like the project that they wanted her to take on, was updating the permanent exhibit. As we mentioned earlier, the permanent exhibit hadn't been updated since 1998. So, you know, it was at that point quite a bit old. Some of the technology was beginning to fail and that sort of thing. And so the board was really interested in her updating the permanent exhibit. So As she started taking a look at the permanent exhibit, she was also like, hey, like, what if we had this offsite collections facility to house our collections? We would give us more square footage here for this update, and we could better care for our objects. And everybody was like, yeah, we've been trying to do that for several years, since 1994. And so the museum has kind of like offered to take that up for the tribe. So we've offered to build this offsite collections facility and work with the tribe, work with some tribal programs to build this offsite collections facility to house our collections. Our building was built in 1976. And then there was a renovation done in 08. Was it
2011, I think.
2011. There was an addition to the building. And so the building was never really built to house collections. We have some issues with our building currently and how we're able to care for collections. Humidity is an issue. We do live in a rainforest. So humidity is an issue anyways, but the building wasn't built in a way that accounted for that. The fact that we live in a rainforest and we get a lot of rain here. The other thing is... the air system in the building is actually under our slab. And as some of you may know, for object care, making sure that your rooms are temperature controlled is really, really important. And so the dated air handling is an issue for our collections. And so like combine that with the moisture that's in our building, it's hard to care for our objects. So an offsite collections facility gives us the opportunity to really think up front about some of these issues that we're currently having. And prior to 2021, we did not have a collections division at the museum. And so thankfully some folks that had been there over the years, Barbara Duncan was one of those folks, took it upon themselves to do some organization and do some documenting and filing and things like that, which is why we have some of the things that we have currently. Really being intentional about our collections and our collections care was something that didn't really come until we hired Evan in 2021. These plans to build this offsite collections facility and update the exhibit also had us talking about our building and updating our current building as well, that sits on our 3-acre footprint downtown. And so we're beginning these two large construction projects currently. One is the offsite collections facility. We're in the process of designing this and like going through this and going through this construction, the beginning stages of this construction project. And then also looking at our downtown location as well and doing renovations to that building also. We're a little bit further along with the offsite collections facility, and that's intentional. We want our collections to move before we start doing things on the downtown site. Just so that way there's a little bit more continuity of care for our objects. It's less packaging and moving and things like that for our objects if we have a permanent place for them to go once they're all packed up. So we're in the middle of this process. And after disruption came down, I really thought that we wouldn't do another exhibit at the museum. I really thought that that was gonna be the last exhibit that we did. I thought we were going to be moving forward with the building projects. But if anybody has ever been in any kind of a part of any kind of building projects, they take a long time and they don't always go as planned. And that's kind of what's happened for us as well. And so we realized last year that the permanent exhibit that had been on display since 1998 was beginning to fail. The technology was beginning to fail. And I think one of the biggest reasons is that like not only was the technology failing, but we couldn't get the same technology because it's technology from 1998. Like they were no longer making this anymore. And we were going to have to do a complete overhaul of all the technology in our exhibit, which just didn't make sense when we know that this is going to be coming down. And so we started planning another exhibit, and as we went out and spoke with our community, we've been doing community outreach over the past couple years, since 2022. And so in all of our community listening sessions, in our community committee that we had, and going out and talking to community, one of the things that always comes up is sovereignty and maintaining our sovereignty and how we're going to do that and talking about sovereignty. And another question that we get all the time from our visitors, from our non-Cherokee or non-Native visitors that come in, is what is sovereignty? Or why do you guys get to have a casino? Or why do you guys get to do, why do you have your own law enforcement? Or those kinds of questions. There's a lot of confusion about like why we have these things in our community for outsiders that are looking in. Like, oh, I...
Or the main one is, my great-great-grandmother was Cherokee, how can I get per cap?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's also a very common thing that our staff gets a lot, right? So it became pretty apparent that we needed to have some conversations about sovereignty. The other thing is we had some of our board that was really interested in learning the story about how we build our economy and why we had such a strong tourist economy in our community and why that was. And so it's because of sovereignty and because we use tourism as a way to build our economy up. And so these are all topics that we can explore under this theme. And sovereignty marks a really important shift for our museum because in the past we've had a timeline, right, for our museum. But one of the things that we're hoping to move towards is a theme-based approach for our exhibits. We want to take themes that are impactful for our community, that'll hopefully be impactful for our visitors too, and explore those themes. And we can talk about different time periods within those themes or perhaps have timelines within the themes, but we can do it in a way that like fully explores a topic and doesn't situate us in a particular moment in time. We can talk about a particular theme throughout time and bring it up to today. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to do at the museum. We're trying to shift the way that we look at exhibits. And so this sovereignty exhibit marks a time for us to really look at that theme-based approach that we want to take or we want to start using see how it reads for folks and see how folks interact with it and see if we're able to successfully use a theme to educate our visitors. And so it's hopefully an important exhibit because it will hopefully shift and change the way that we approach doing exhibits in the future.
I think one of the really interesting kind of examples that kind of brings all these things together is the big sign when you come onto the Quella boundary that says the Cherokee Reservation. Can you talk a little bit about that sign and how it's wrong and tribal sovereignty?
Yes, I can do that. So, yes, so when you come into Cherokee, I don't know if any of you have been to Cherokee. I know you have. when you come into Cherokee, there are some signs that say, "Welcome to the Cherokee Indian Reservation." It was born out of sovereignty, which is why I do have love for those signs, even though they are wrong. So the reason why they're wrong is that we actually aren't a reservation. The Eastern Band of Cherokee, unlike most other tribal nations, do not live on a reservation. We actually, our land base is called the Quella Boundary. And it's called a Quella Boundary because after the removal period of the 1830s, caused from the Indian Removal Act of 1830, the Cherokees that remained in the East, we bought back all of the land that we currently have. So we purchased back all of our own land to be able to have our communities where they are. So because they were purchased back by us, it is not a reservation. A reservation typically in a traditional sense is land that was given, and I like quote, I know you can't hear me on the radio, but like quotation given to tribes to live on, and they acted almost like, some reservations acted almost like concentration camps. Folks had to have permission to leave or go off of them. They had to have, people had to have like slips to go on to reservations. You had to get like, I don't know, passes? I don't know what they called them. They were these kind of like holding places, and typically...
I mean, like the rations, like ration cards, like literally everything was controlled including the food.
Yes, by the government. And there are some things that come out of that that we still do, like fry bread comes out of those times and comes out of like rationing for reservations and things like that. But for the Eastern Band in particular, that was not our story. We didn't, you know, the United States didn't like give us, quote unquote, land. And so we purchased it all back. We purchased all of the land that we have back. And so that's why it's a boundary and not a reservation. However, the reason why we have those signs is during, like, you know, the mid 20th century, when we're creating this tourist economy there, there was expectations that non-native visitors brought. So the types of tourists that were coming in there were non-native visitors. And they had these Hollywood stereotypical expectations of what they were supposed to see when they came to an Indian community that didn't really align with Cherokee culture and Cherokee identity at the time, or really ever. So they had these expectations, and it
wasn't based in reality.
It wasn't based in reality, and then the things that they did understand about Native people were often of Plains tribes represented in Westerns. And so they had these conceptions that they brought with them to see, like, headdresses and leather and fringe and things like that.
Teepees.
And then teepees, yes. And then they got to Cherokee, and there was, like, just, like, really poor people in, like, regular clothes. And so we started capitalizing, our community started capitalizing on those stereotypes and on those images. One of the things that Shana's talked about recently that really resonated with me was strategic essentialism, and how this was a strategic choice that we made as a community to adopt some of these stereotypes, adopt some of these things, so that way we could feed our families, so that way we could create an economy in our community, like give the tourists what they want. And then, you know, of course, like they weren't living that in their homes, but out in public spaces, they were really leaning into stereotypes to build this economy. And I don't actually know where I was going with that. Why we started to, the signs, I'm sorry. So yes, so the signs come out of this. The signs are a part of that. And calling our community a reservation, right? The Cherokee Indian Reservation was a very strategic move. It was branding. And it was creating a brand for our community to build an economy off of. And Kuala Boundary didn't have quite the ring that I guess our non-native tourists and visitors were expecting. And so it was very strategic. And so I do have love for those signs. I hope that at some point they do come down, because they aren't correct. And I do think that sometimes even our own community doesn't realize the history behind those signs and why it says that we're a reservation when we're not. And so it's a really, they're important. I do have love for them, but I do hope that at some point they're changed, because a lot of people had to fight for our land and for us to have a Kuala Boundary. They had to be very smart, very intentional. They put their own money in, pulled their own money to be able to buy land communally as a tribe. And so there was just so much intentionality that came behind getting our land back, buying our land back, that I think that that's such a compelling story, that sometimes calling our community a reservation just seems to gloss over.
And I did want to add, there's a couple ways that the Kuala Boundary is similar to, like, Indian reservations, in that it's federal trust status land, so there are different laws and different protections in place for the Kuala Boundary, similar to reservations. So once the land was purchased back, it took a long time, but it did eventually go into the federal trust status. So that means the federal government holds the Kuala Boundary, air quote, in trust for the tribe.
Yes.
The tribe, you know, the federal government doesn't allow tribes to just do things for themselves. So
what are y'all hoping, I guess, to move the conversation forward, I feel like, is what this tribal sovereignty exhibit is all about, is like talking about the current reality for the Eastern Band of Cherokee and those kind of discussions. What are you hoping to come out of this when you launch this exhibit and, you know, the community members come in, and what do you hope to talk about tribal sovereignty with them?
Well, I mean, specifically with the tourism section of the exhibit, like, I hope that when people go through downtown and see stereotypes that exist today, I hope they understand where they come from, and I hope that people realize that we don't have to do that anymore. Like, it's a thing of the past, and it's okay to let go of that. And I hope that people think about what sovereignty and what the community could look like in the future rather than what it looks like now. And I hope that people are educated and understand that, I hope that people understand the difference between being a federally recognized tribal citizen of a tribe versus having potential unsubstantiated Cherokee ancestry. I hope that they can understand that better when they leave the exhibit.
Yeah. And I think for our community, I just hope that they come away with a deeper understanding of what sovereignty can mean, because it can mean so many things. And I think that's one of the things about our exhibit that I really like, is that it's not any one thing. There's so many things that that relates back to our sovereignty, and that is an expression of sovereignty as a tribal nation. And so I hope that they can start seeing things that they're doing in their daily life, our community members, that are expressions of that sovereignty that we have, our inherent sovereignty as a tribal nation, and that that they come away with hopefully a sense of pride. I like, as I'm reading through and as I've been researching for this exhibit, I am just so incredibly proud at just the innovation and the tactfulness that my ancestors had. They were so smart in the way that they approached things and the way that they fought for our nation, for our land, and the way that they the innovative ideas that they had in these, like, really tumultuous times that I don't know if I could, I'm like, I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could have the, like, wherewithal to be in a time where, like, all of my family's leaving and we're losing all of our land and people are being run out of their homes, to consider ways that multiple different ways and tactics to make sure that we still continued a presence, that Cherokee people still continued a presence in our ancestral homeland. And how incredibly inspiring is that as a young Cherokee person to see these amazing, smart, intelligent, very innovative individuals that we come from. And so I hope for our community that they see those things and that they feel inspired to continue to fight for our sovereignty and to continue to fight for treaty rights like some of our ancestors have, and continue the work that they've done.
Well, I want to open it up for questions, and I feel like this conversation could go 100 different ways, and I'm kind of interested in what y'all are interested in. So, anybody has any questions?
Oh, I said a question.
On the spot. Oh, you have a question?
Go for it.
Yeah.
No, I just wanted you to talk a little bit more about the distinction you made in the last response about unsubstantiated claims versus actual.
Yeah.
She's a lawyer.
Yeah.
Well, I just think that a lot of people may not fully understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Cherokee people are the most documented group of indigenous people in the world, it seems like. And if you're Cherokee, there's going to be documentation of it in the past. People had to apply for citizenship to be members of federally recognized tribes. And there's so many stories that we hear on literally a daily basis that people are, they claim to be Cherokee. And, you know, they have no connection to families on the Qualla boundary or out in Oklahoma. They have no basis for the claims that they're making. And a lot of times it's from hearsay and
family
lore.
Stories. Yeah, family lore.
And yeah, if you haven't done the research to kind of figure out if that's true or not, then maybe you shouldn't say that you're Cherokee, because it does actual damage to living Cherokee people who on a daily basis have to fight for their sovereignty. So.
Yeah. And I think one of the things, and we do explore this in the exhibit, is just like this idea about being a tribal citizen or a tribal member, of a federally recognized nation, as opposed to having ancestry. I do believe we have a very complicated history, and I'm sure that there's folks out there that have Cherokee ancestry that aren't tribal citizens or tribal members of a Cherokee nation. I think that having ancestry, like Evan said, doesn't necessarily make you Cherokee, and it's because we are a sovereign nation, and we do get to, as a sovereign nation, we get to set up the criteria of what that means and what that looks like, of how you become a citizen of our tribe. And so understanding that that just because you have ancestry doesn't necessarily make you Eastern Band, or it doesn't necessarily make you Cherokee Nation or United Gudewa Band, which are the three federally recognized Cherokee nations. I think that there is this very, based off of a lot of family lore and these family stories and a lot of families, especially in the Southeast, about having Cherokee ancestry, there is this almost folks come here sometimes with this feeling that that somehow our museum or the Kuala Boundary or everything belongs to them. And so we wanted to make that distinction of why that's not the case, and why, because of tribal sovereignty, how to become a member and a citizen of our tribe looks, and that it is a governmental process, it is a governmental decision from our nation of how that looks and what that looks like. And the other thing I'll say is that Evan mentioned a little bit about the damage that can cause for our community. And I do think there's a lot of misrepresentation out there about Cherokee people. And one of the things that can be really hard for us, and we call it Indian country, or amongst other native tribes, when we're around other native tribes, they get this all the time too. So when somebody hears that they're from some sort of native nation, a lot of non-native people will be like, oh wow, as a way to, I guess, relate. I don't think that they're meaning any harm by it, but as a way to relate, they're saying oh well, my great-grandmother was Cherokee. And Native people around the nation get this all the time.
And in Canada.
And globally, there's actually international groups that claim Cherokee identity. And so being out around other Native people, sometimes when you say that you're Cherokee, and I am so proud to be Cherokee because of our history and our culture, and I love being Cherokee. But sometimes when we're out around other Native people, they don't believe me that I'm actually Native. And that can be damaging. That can be harmful in creating those relationships with other tribal communities. The other thing is the misrepresentation. A lot of times folks that are claiming a Cherokee identity may have a lot of misunderstandings of what that means and what that looks like, and then they go out in public spaces and represent themselves that way, and they spread a lot of misinformation, and that can be really harmful to our community.
And take resources from actual Cherokee people.
Yes, and that is also a thing. So I think that's an important topic to talk about and for folks to understand. And it's not meant in any kind of way that's negative. It's meant to inform folks about the realities of what this means and what it is and what it looks like,
and how to be a good ally to Indigenous people.
Yes.
And Dakota mentioned there's three federally recognized Cherokee tribes. There's over 250 groups that claim to be Cherokee. So you can
over 250 groups globally. So there's groups in other countries that claim to have Cherokee ancestry and identity. So this is a huge issue and a huge problem. And I think about and I forget her name, but there was I think she was a professor that claimed an African American identity.
Rachel Dolezal.
There you go. I just think about the shock and awe that everybody had when they were she's misrepresenting herself as this identity, and it happens every single day with Cherokee folks. It happens every single day with Cherokee people. People misrepresent themselves every day as Cherokee people, and they misrepresent themselves as having Cherokee identity. And I just like wish there was like even like the tiniest little bit of outrage about it that was like outside of our community to be like, wow, this is actually like kind of crazy, kind of insane that we've got all of these people. And I don't always think that it comes from a place of malice. I think that there's just this really big misunderstanding in the United States about who Native people are, what we believe in, what our governments look like, what sovereignty is, which is why this is such an important exhibit to do.
Anybody else have any questions?
Yeah.
If you had to recommend a book about the history of the Eastern Band, or just history of Cherokee in general, that's not like whitewash, that's like accurate history.
That is a harder question than you know. And this is like one of the reasons why I wanted to become a historian. Majority of our history is written by white men. And that just goes for all American history. That was one of the reasons why I almost felt like a responsibility to become a historian, because I was like, well, I am a Native woman. Like, I'm a Cherokee woman. You know, part of the reason for that is that for a long time, we didn't really have access to education. My dad did not have access to education. Me and my older sister are the first generation of college students to graduate from college in our families. And there's a lot of that going on in our community right now. And the reason why is because we now have funding that supports our education, which is amazing. And we're seeing like this whole generation of Cherokee people that are coming out of college with educations and experience. So I have no doubt that these things are coming, that we are going to have Cherokee history written by Cherokee people. That's one of the things that I'm so excited about our exhibits, because we are able to use these like amazing, smart Cherokee people to support the scholarship and work that we're doing in our exhibit. And it's the first time that we're able to like tell our story from our perspective. And so there's not a ton of books that are like actually Cherokee written books, but there are a few. What I would say is that it takes a little bit of digging and a little bit of looking around, and you can find some really good sources. There are some really good sources that have been written recently that are non-Native authors, but that do a really great job of like really looking a little bit more at like a Cherokee perspective. What I would say is that any non-Native author can never... I get that question all the time. So the authors will come to me and ask me that. It's like, how can I incorporate a Cherokee perspective? And I was like, you can't. Like, because inherently you can't. Like, it's going to read differently. You have a bias. Everybody has a bias. There's some authors that really have, I think, taken time to interact with Cherokee folks and listen to Cherokee people and incorporate those stories into the way that they tell their stories. And one of them that's just coming to mind really quickly is actually here at WCU, Dr. Andrew Denson wrote a book called Monuments to Absence. Goodness gracious, that's what it's called. Monuments to Absence. And it's a really great book, because it looks at the way that... I guess non-Native people remember Cherokee people and Cherokee culture and whatever. I would maybe start there. I think that it, like, he does a really good job of, like, especially if you're a non-Native person, like, kind of, like, easing you into, like, these ideas of why there's these misconceptions and why these things are happening. He does it through a historical lens. So I would start there. The other thing that I'll say is that I will have a bibliography online of all the sources that we use for sovereignty.
Do you like that one?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So Theda Perdue is another one that has written a lot of books about Cherokee folks she's done a really great job of telling our stories and things like that. So there are some things. There's also one that was recently written by Lisa Leffler, and... and Tom Belt. Tom Belt is a Cherokee Nation citizen, and he's been, he retired from WCU, but he was here for at WCU for a really, really long time. And I think it's called Sounds of Towhee?
Yeah.
Sounds of Towhee. And that one, I haven't completed the book yet. I have the book, and I've, like, been able to, like, read certain little such things through it, and I'm excited to read the whole thing, but I'm sure if Tom Bell was a part of that, then it's probably pretty, and Lisa's, like, amazing. So.
I love Lisa.
Yeah, Lisa's great. So maybe those are a couple that you could start with. I don't necessarily know if they're a comprehensive history, but yeah, I think maybe they would give some insight.
And if you like podcasts,
oh, yeah.
So Adrienne Keene is a Cherokee Nation citizen. She has an interesting story. She grew up in California because her grandmother was displaced from her allotment land in Oklahoma. So she has this story of, like, constant reconnecting work that she has to do, even though she's an enrolled citizen of a tribal nation. But her podcast is called
All My Relations.
All My Relations. It is my favorite podcast.
And she does it alongside Matika Wilbur, so that one's really great.
Yeah, Matika is Swinomish and Tulalip.
Mm-hmm, I think so.
Yeah.
And their podcast really focuses on, like, this wide array of just, like, Native contemporary life and challenges, existence, and all kinds of things. So that's a great one. A great one to look up for sure. There are some books coming out. I know that Rebecca Nagel has a podcast as well that's, like, also amazing, called This Land, and she's actually going to be releasing a book later this year, and so that one's, like, maybe one to look out for.
Sure. So you described the exhibit Disruption as an open creative platform for Cherokee artists. You said that you didn't really give them any parameters per the case or anything, or besides the case. Have you ever thought about finding indigenous or native artists who replicate the artifacts that were given back so that you could also support artists in other nations with their work?
I'll say we haven't done that to support maybe, like, other nations, but so we're still in the middle of the NAGPRA consultation process. It's it's a really long process. We have to invite any tribe that might have some connection to the objects in our collection. And so one of the things that we have considered, if they are a Cherokee object and if our TIPO consents to this, is we want to 3D print the ceramics and also do, like, a 3D rendering in the computer so that our ceramic artists and potters have access to these materials, and we can also do right by them and put them back in the ground where they're supposed to be. So that way we have the knowledge still, but we're doing right by these objects.
Yeah.
For other nations, we would not do that because that's not our place. We don't know what their protocols are with their funerary or sacred objects, and so that would be up to them to determine what they want to do with it.
And one of the things that Evan's done since he's began at the museum is started to explore
repatriations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that, right, like, NAGPRA is not perfect, and NAGPRA is just a, like, starting point. It should be a starting point for organizations and universities and museums around the nation. So it should be a starting point. Ethical repatriation is something that we want to make sure that we're exploring and that we are participating in, and that for multiple reasons. We have a lot of things in our collections because we're one of the only tribes in the Southeast. We're one of the few tribes in the South, not one of the only. We're one of the few tribes in the Southeast. And yeah, I think people just, like, come to us with, like, Indian things. And so we've, over the years, have collected, and because we didn't have a collections division, we've collected, like, all this stuff from, like, all these other nations. that doesn't necessarily belong to us as Cherokee people. And so making sure that we get those back to the communities that they're from is something that we are like actively trying to do. Evan just this past year worked really, really hard on an ethical repatriation for a Kiowa cradle board. And it went back to its community in October of this past year. And he was able to actually like locate descendants of the person that the cradle board was made from, and they like came, and the nation's leaders came and like accepted this on behalf of their nation and that sort of thing. So it was just like a really wonderful moment to be able to like give them back these items that belong to their families. I mean, these items belong to our families. They're not just like, you know, we think, I think most museum think about their objects as objects. And we think about them as ancestors. We think about them as pieces of our ancestors, right? Like they made these things. They put their energy and time into making these things. And so our objects to us are related to us directly. They are, I would say, like the best and most amazing version of like a family heirloom.
And I think just to expand on what Dakota kind of hinted at with that NAGPRA should be a starting point is that this year they passed updated NAGPRA laws to push museums and universities to actually return some of these objects. So there are a lot of objects and actual ancestral remains that have not been returned to tribes, even though they do fall within NAGPRA and it is cataloged and it is at these universities. And so the Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, updated that law this year, but it's still unclear what the, I guess, punishments would be for not doing that. It's there's some fees that can be put forward to the universities, and we've been following that as a journalism organization. Yeah, the fees are very small, and ProPublica has done some wonderful reporting as far as like following exactly how much where all of those things are. But
yeah.
I have a follow-up question.
Yeah.
Say like your average person, a non-native visitor to a museum or a collection at a university, see something that they would think falls under those regulations. Mm-hmm. Could they report that institution to that?
Yes, you can report it to National NAGPRA. There's a website.
It's housed under the National Park Service for some reason, yes. Which is like really ironic because the Park Service has also like stolen so much indigenous land and objects. But anyways, that's where it's housed. So.
Yeah, it's housed. Yeah, so under the National Park Service website, there is a section that you can look up NAGPRA, and you can look up National NAGPRA and how to submit a claim. Anybody can submit a National NAGPRA claim. Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you know how effective those claims are when they're made?
It is a very slow and long process, and that's one of the critiques over the years that since NAGPRA began, is that it is such a long, slow process. I think one of the shortfalls of it is that you have to complete a full inventory before you can start approaching or before you can submit everything to National NAGPRA, which for museums and organizations is, obviously taking them a really long time. That law was passed in 1990, and there is just thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of ancestors, like actual human remains, on shelves, and tons of items. And that's you know, not just in the United States, but that's globally as well. There is, the British Museum has a ton of Cherokee stuff, particularly Cherokee items, because we dealt with the British for a really, really long time in our history. And so they have a ton of Cherokee objects in their museum. So it's not just in the U.S., it's internationally.
Although
globally.
I think North Carolina is particularly, you can speak to this, right? UNC.
Yeah, there are a number of remains and ancestors at the UNC anthropology department that they have that they are supposed to be returning.
Yeah. So hopefully they're going through their NAGPRA inventory and reaching out to the appropriate TIPO offices and things like that. Hopefully they're doing that work. But it has been a really long time. The other thing, the other issue with NAGPRA is that it's hard to regulate, or it's hard to enforce, I guess I should say. So, you know, again, there are opportunities for fines. They're not often, museums are not often fined, or universities, places that house these objects are not often fined. And one of the criteria for NAGPRA is any organization that receives federal funding is supposed to go through the NAGPRA process.
Well, great. Yeah, we could definitely talk about this much longer, but thank you so much for your time, and thank you all for your questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, we need to.